Welcome to Energy Stew. I'd like to ask you, have you whispered to the Himalayas, or do they whisper to you? What's your relationship with them? They're mighty powerful, but maybe it's not about them. Maybe it's about us. And they're an opportunity that we can aspire to understand that many wise men and women have found themselves in quite advanced stages of consciousness in that region. And it attracts people all the time. I've always been attracted to the Himalayas. I haven't really been there, at least in this life. And I want to speak with somebody in the show who has been there a number of times and has so much to say and has written a book called Whispers of the Himalaya. And its name is Ajahn Boris. Ajahn, welcome to Energy Stew. I'm so happy to interview
you. Thank you, Peter. A delight to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, this is very important to talk about your revelations of visiting the Himalayas, but also what's interesting is that it started for you very young. You had an experience, I guess you were a teenager then, and with a psychedelic drug that pushed your consciousness in ways that opened you up and launched you on this life, right?
Exactly, true. Yeah, want me to convey that story?
Please.
Okay. Yeah, this was back in 1970. I was a senior in high school at the time. And my little group of friends, we were just kind of experimenting with psychedelic drugs. And one evening we took something that was called mescaline. I have no idea what it really was. And to just kind of condense the story, I could go into a lot of detail, but just to say it briefly, we were sitting in this car together, having a wonderful conversation, very super fluid in the sense that, you know, one person would say just a few words and it would convey great meaning to everyone and who would then chime in. So there was a lot of unity, a great sense of love, a lot of blissful feeling. And this conversation was just amazing, very philosophical and deep. And it seemed like just so true and something so essential to what life is about. And I couldn't tell you what it was about exactly now, but that's how it felt then. And so at a certain point, my mind started to go too fast, is how I thought of it then, for me to speak out the words that I was thinking. And so I dropped out of the conversation. It was just kind of internal. And my mind was going in this vein that just seemed so profound. It seemed like I was on the trail of the secret of the universe. And I was experiencing a tremendous amount of love and ecstatic kind of blissful feeling and intelligence. And it just kept getting, and so my mind kept going in this vein faster and faster. And then it was if I dropped into a level where what I was thinking was too fast or too subtle to be expressed in words or even in thoughts, normal thoughts in terms of language. And so then my thinking became just these currents of pure intelligence, pure energy, powerful currents rotating around faster and faster around some core. And now I really knew I was onto the track of the secret of the universe. There was something so profound about this. More and more love, more and more bliss. And then in a moment, one of those currents of attention, of pure creative intelligence dropped into that core. And at that point, there was a gap. And when I emerged from that gap, all I could say was, that was God. And I just kind of whispered it, and the people in the car turned around, and I kind of assumed that they also had that experience because we had been so unified. But what that gap contained was this: I'd have to say it by metaphor, basically. Imagine you're the sun. Now, the sun is amazingly, you know, big. It's a million times bigger than the Earth, approximately. And so you are the sun, and your being is comprised of pure light, pure energy, but also pure intelligence and pure love. So you're this vast, incomprehensible mass of love, intelligence, energy, creativity, all that. And still, somewhere you would end. So let's say you are a trillion suns, which is, of course, completely incomprehensible. Our mind can't grasp that. But that's what this was like, a trillion suns, except even then, that trillion suns would end somewhere and space would begin. So this was like that, except there was no end. It was absolutely infinite. And in that entire infinite expanse of pure light, intelligence, energy, love, there was not a single ripple of activity. So it was absolute, indescribable peace also. So that is what I experienced when I was 18 and I came out of that. As I said, I just whispered, that was God. And from that moment on, my life was changed because that experience kind of left, imprinted me with a few truths that were just self-evident. One was that what I had experienced was not the drug didn't produce that. It had somehow opened me up to that, but no drug can create infinity. No drug can do that. So it had to be something far beyond the drug. Secondly, I knew that that was what we were meant to experience and live all the time. I just knew that. This was the goal of our lives. Certainly it was the goal of my life, but I knew for everybody, that's it. That's our source. And finally, I had this certainty that the way to live that was somehow to purify myself in some way. I wasn't entirely clear what that meant, but I knew it meant getting rid of all distortions, you know, distortions in the way in thinking, distortions in the way of feeling, and in terms of my behavior. So I immediately knew I had to stop taking drugs. I was going to stop drinking. We were partying animals, basically. So I was going to stop doing that. I had to stop smoking. And I had to clean up my act. I just knew that. And so none of my friends were on board with that change. And so I became rather isolated for that last part of my senior year in high school. And one day I was looking through my dad's library, just skimming the book, seeing what was there. And I came across this thin book that was the Bhagavad Gita. And I knew nothing about Eastern thought. Neither did my dad. It had been given to him just because he had taken some management course taught by a Jesuit priest who included this in the curriculum. But other than that, he knew nothing about it. I knew nothing about it. So I picked that up and I started flipping through it. And Peter, it was as if I had written it. I mean, even now, if I go to read a book that I have written, I've written four books, if I pick up one and start reading it, it won't be as familiar to me as that one was to me at that point. It was just expressing my pulse. It was just expressing everything I had experienced. And so I tried to meditate, you know, based on what I was reading there, failed miserably, trying to meditate from just sitting there without any instruction. I don't recommend that. It's important to get good instruction, I think. And so that led me to start reading some Tibetan Buddhist books, which you may be familiar with, the Evans-Wentz series. I don't know if you read those. The Tibetan Book of the Dead, the Tibetan Book of the Great Liberation, through knowing the, you know, one's mind. Those, there are several books there. And I read all those and decided I wanted to go to Tibet. But here I was, a senior in high school, scheduled to go to college the next fall, and Chinese occupation, you know, what could I really do there? So I went to college and saw a poster for meditation class, and I took that meditation class, and that was the beginning. And from there, you know, I studied to teach TM, and I've learned to do that. And then I went on to learn many other forms of meditation. So that's kind of the course and the backdrop for how I ended up in India. Actually, one of the teachers I studied with was Amici, the so-called hugging saint. And I was with her in India, living in her ashram for about 4 years. And she had made me the ashram meditation teacher, which was a great honor. But it was also a very busy job. And so one year when she... Excuse me, sorry. I'm sitting here with my dogs. Hold on, they'll stop. Okay, no bark, guys. Okay, so anyway, I was in the ashram meditation teacher one year when she was doing her world tour. I went to the Himalayas, and that was in 1996, and that's what the book is about, that whole journey of that year.
Uh-huh. Well, your book is quite a journey and very fascinating. I loved every page of it. It's such an amazing work of spirituality that you speak of your spiritual journey in the Himalayas, and so much about what this journey is about. And it was fascinating what you had to deal with on this trip to your cave in the Himalayas. And it was, you know, right away it caught my fancy, because you got up there and you're looking for a cave to meditate in, and you found out they were all taken. And it's like, who would have thought? And certainly you ended up finding one. It was a little hole in the wall, and so much of the book is about the trials of all of that. So there's so much in your book really about what spirituality is, other than just, well, if we meditate, we'll be spiritual. Mm-hmm. No, it's because you were meditating many, many hours every day in very simple circumstances, let's say. Mm-hmm. just a bare cave in the mountains. And what you found was that life is life. And you can meditate all you want, and you step out of your cave, and boom, or even in your cave, mm-hmm. there'll be all kinds of insects and who knows what. Then you have to eat, and there's so many struggles in life that we have. And certainly there have been Rinpoches who have, like Kalu Rinpoche, who had been a friend of mine, had been in retreat for 26 years, but he was well served. You know, he didn't have to do what you had to do, was find your way and climb up and down cliffs and be caught in terrible weather. And I mean, it's amazing. This book is such a wonderful adventure. But in the adventure, you find so many inner and outer truths. Mm-hmm. And what is it all about? You know, why am I meditating? What does meditation really do for us? And quite a lot, because you are still teaching meditation, but you found out it doesn't do everything. And so what is everything? And that's what I'd love to, you know, talk more and more and more with you about, because we're striving for this oneness. We're striving for this peace, this stillness, this light, this bliss, to become one in the universe. And why? What does it accomplish? Is it an ego thing or not? You know, is it, you know, what are we really after? What are we trying to satisfy? And I believe that we're satisfying evolution to return to oneness, and you know, to have to begin a new universe all over again after that. Mm-hmm. But in a sense, we get ahead of the game trying to, you know, finish the universe with our meditations.
Yeah, beautiful points, Peter. I absolutely agree with you. And in fact, I mean, one thing that's always been a mystery to me, because literally, like you say, I've done a lot of meditation. I once kind of figured out, and it's somewhere around 60,000 hours of meditation, you know, so I've dived into that world of meditation and gone as, you know, far with it as I can take it. And yet, honestly, I look at my life and I say, okay, I am no saint. What's the problem here, you know? And what I
realized, all saints. How about
yeah,
that?
Or that way, yeah. But you know, in terms of how I think of saintliness, I know
right,
that
of course.
I have a ways to go yet. And what I realized is it's something very interesting that human beings, we all are after our own happiness, initially at least on this path. And it doesn't change when you start spiritual practices. You still are interested in your own happiness. And ultimately, at some point, that has to shift because your own happiness, it's related to your ego, you know, and the ego can't hold infinity. So it's going to get distorted and lopsided if it tries to hold infinity. So I understand that you've had a deep background in Tibetan Buddhism, and I love some of the Buddhist writings, and particularly those of Shantideva, you know, the guide to the Bodhisattva's way of life, that kind of thing. And what he points out quite beautifully is that at some point that interest in our own happiness has to shift and turn kind of inside out, where we're more interested in the happiness of others. And because we realize our own happiness is kind of small in the grand scheme of things, it's much more worthwhile goal to devote yourself to the happiness and enlightenment of everyone else, of others. Sure. And that is, I believe, a key to integration. It's not just an inspiring idea. I think that is essential to integrate the benefits of meditation so that we're becoming more and more selfless. We're applying our heightened awareness and consciousness to a worthwhile, worthy goal of uplifting others. And so anyway, that's something I've contemplated for a while now and feel it's very important to integration.
And I believe we're coming into a time where more and more people are going to be awakened to a higher consciousness, but it's a higher consciousness that includes love and light that automatically wants to share it. And so what you're ascribing to is how we're evolving as a civilization to support each other and make it a better world.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so the process is getting there, and we're not quite there yet, but it's growing. So we can talk a lot about this, and I want to hopefully do a future show with you about what this all comes to and why we're on this path of wanting to meditate and wanting to know our light better. But I want to come back to your book, because your book is so fascinating and wonderful, because this is an opportunity to just to have your experience. You're such a good writer, and you talk about so many of your adventures that were really difficult, being up way up in the mountains and what you had to deal with, because part of it is that you went there with very little. It wasn't that you were some rich guy and you were carried up there and taken care of. You really needed to be taken care of by, let's call it, the universe, and through serendipity, through things happening, through magic, that things showed up when you thought all was lost. Many times.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, that is one thing I there's sort of another backstory to that, but we had sold everything we owned to go live in India and had decided to live a kind of life of renunciation. So we had donated to charity almost everything
for our daughters, our two daughters. And so when I went to the Himalayas, I was basically completely broke. I not only wanted to live in a cave, I needed to live in a cave because that's all I could afford, namely nothing.
I think your phone went on speaker mode, so
it's a little bit okay. Let me try to change this. Let's see.
Hear you, but it was a different sound. So.
Oh, okay.
So it's all right if you can't do that because I can still hear you.
Is it okay or is it not good, the sound?
It's more of a hollow sound now with the speaker on, but.
Okay, how about this?
That's perfect. Okay, good. So what it is that you took the train all the way through India to get up into the Himalayas and had just enough to get by. And in bad circumstances, you might have lost it all because people stole from caves. There was really not great safety. And you even met a guy who had stolen from a cave and you were
right.
Dedicated to putting it back, taking it back. And so you met all kinds of people up there, not all remarkably kind or spiritual, and were tested in many ways. And I think that it always happens in life. You know, the minute you feel like you're in this most blissful, peaceful place, you all of a sudden you go out on the street and crazy things happen. And you certainly had that. So many stories that are in your book that are fascinating. And you put yourself through great tests.
Yeah, well, thank you, Peter. Yeah, my intent to go up there was simply to meditate in isolation. And lo and behold, I had, as you say, quite an adventure and really a lot of contact with the culture there. And not only the Indian culture and many of the beautiful sadhus, you know, the holy men who had come to that area for their spiritual practices, and really got to know some of them very well. And it was just wonderful community. But also had encounters with the Indian Army with some interesting Westerners, let's say interesting in quotes. And, you know, and so there was a lot of interpersonal, you know, interaction that was very interesting and became part of the journey, yeah. Very much so.
Well, because in the book, you question yourself a lot about the people you're meeting and your reactions to them and whether or not you're really a good enough person because of your judgments about them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, all the ego stuff comes up. In fact, that's, I think, completely appropriate. I don't think anybody can just retire from the world, you know, take themselves out of the flow of life and expect to evolve. Life is going to get at you no matter where you go. Even if I was in a cave in a remote forest at 10,000 feet in the Himalayas, well outside of a very tiny little hamlet, you know, in like away from that. So I shouldn't have had much contact with anybody, but, you know, somehow life got in there and made sure that I was aware of all my stuff. You know, and it was, and that is part of it. That became really part of it.
Well, there's a truth in life about living who you're supposed to be. And you certainly had your personality, your values going for you up there, where you met other people who had very different values than you had and very different personalities. And you learned, I mean, there's a parts in the book where you talk about becoming one with everything and really allowing people to be themselves without judgment. And, you know, and that goes back to the Bhagavad Gita, where near the end of it, Arjuna, the hero, learns about oneness from Krishna, his chariot driver.
Right.
And then the war is about to start, and Arjuna is the prince and the chief warrior. And he goes, how can I go to war now because I'm so spiritual? And Krishna says, no, you're designed to be a warrior, so you have to go to war. So in other words, we're asked to still be ourselves, no matter how spiritual, how evolved we become. We have to live in the truth of our own spark of God, let's call it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you were, and you did, and you saw all these people doing theirs, and you got to a point where you were allowing them to be that true spark.
Right, right. And as you say, like, there were a lot of insights along the way. You know, when you're, that is one thing. Here you are meditating many hours a day, maybe 14 hours a day or so. Your consciousness gets very refined and very acute. And so that's where the whispers of the Himalaya came in, because you're in this beautiful, amazingly the physical beauty of nature there is just spectacular. And you're doing all this meditation, so your senses are absolutely delighting in everything, and you're having all kinds of inner revelations. And then all these challenges come up in relationships, in the, you know, to kind of just hold that mirror up again. And so it was a multi-dimensional experience. I even while I was there, I realized, well, this is, as you say, something I need to share. Because a lot of people would maybe fantasize about having such an intensive retreat and not know what it's like. So this is, you know, a chance to share that with people.
Right, it's very challenging.
And yeah, in all its dimensions. So yeah, that's what the book is.
I mean, there's so many points where you could have died.
Oh, yeah, that too.
Yeah. I mean, you were in very dangerous situations. You put yourself through, you know, great pain and suffering at times, physically. And it's not an easy place up there, but neither is life anywhere. And so there's so many great lessons in your book just about life and who we are and why we're here. That's why I really would love to do another show with you and get into some of the details of your story.
Absolutely, you can count on it, Peter. Just okay. let's do it.
So let me just check my timing here. We have about 30 seconds left. So Ajay and Boris, Whispers of the Himalaya. And let's have a website that people can go to.
Sure, ajayan.com. That's ajayan.com. And there, of course, Amazon is where you'd buy the book. But at ajayan.com, you can have a free guided meditation. You can see the kind of style of meditation that I teach, just a taste of it anyway. And so that's something you can see all about whatever I offer in courses and such.
Great. What a pleasure speaking with you, Ajayan.
Well, Peter, thank you so much. And look forward to talking to you again.
Great, thank you. And this is Peter Roth, your host of Energy Stew at PRN.FM. I can be reached at peter@heartriver, heartriver.org, or 212-222-7748. I'd love to hear from you, and thanks so much for listening.